This is the most natural thing now ever.
One of Dublin's great observational minds, Roddy Doyle. Thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, it might be a pleasure.
The sinking sand of despair, the smell of dread in the air. I'm head to toe in my own fear. I'm going to die, no need to cry. Ah.
Your generation of Ireland had such a different experience, and your Christian brother, St. Fintan's Sutton guy, which is famously known for that kind of Christian brother level of abuse, which was nearly sadistic, pleasurable, pretty freakish. There was a bit of comedy in it at the end when Brian McFadden put it in the video when he wasn't actually in the school, which is something that's always stood out for me. But why did you grow into someone who was so willing to criticise and analyse how you were raised?
Both my parents were quietly devout in their own way. And my dad went to the Christian Brothers, James Street. And he was there for 3 years before he left to start his apprenticeship. And I was really shocked when he told me he loved her. It was really good for him. There was a Christian brother who gave him books to read. And because there were very few books at home. And he had a great time. He didn't want to leave school.
But does it get to a Stockholm syndrome level, like the kind of US military? I was talking to a guy once. No. He said they break your spirit, then they make you devout.
My experience of the Christian Brothers was, I suppose, looking back now, and it's nearly 50 years since I left. It's 47 years since I left. It was all, the friendship was just brilliant. And because the place was so, and not uniquely to the one I went to, St. Fintan's, but I'd say the atmosphere in was potentially, you know, literally violent. And the consequences of being caught laughing at the back of the room were, if not literally, life or death. You know, and the level of laughter and the jeopardy. You know that old that phrase that's used a lot when you hear people talking about writing scripts. Where's the jeopardy? Anybody who went to a Christian Brothers school wouldn't need that explained to them, you know. So that was the good side of it, to my mind.
Would you still be friends with the guy you were refusing to laugh with?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, something shared, you know. But the bad side of it was the, I suppose, the sheer neglect of what I would call real education, but also the violence. I was walking through Fairview, not far from where I live, and I saw this fella I went to school with. Now, this is about maybe 15 years ago. So I hadn't seen him since we left school, the day we left school. We were never that close. But we both recognised each other, and we went and we had a chat, and we agreed we'd go for a pint. So we met a few weeks later for a pint. So this is two men with families, children, decades since we'd seen each other. And within 2 minutes, we were both talking about the same episode, the same incident where we'd both been beaten by a teacher, not a Christian brother, a teacher who taught neither of us, who used to roam the corridors looking for opportunities, really, to batter kids. And he chose me and him and a few others that particular day. And if I was a method actor and I needed to shake, I needed to be frightened, I just imagine myself at the back of that line of boys waiting to be walloped with a leather strap from this man who was sweating so much, the sweat landed on us as he hit us. And it's only years later that I realised he was getting sexual pleasure from it, you know.
Was he also sexually abusing kids?
That I don't know. I wrote a story where I used that episode. It wasn't about me. But I used that episode. I came away from that really, my hands were so sore for the rest of the day. I was holding the metal bars of the desk to cool them down, you know. An absolute agony, as if every bone in my hands was broken. But the one thing that made me feel good was the fact that I hadn't cried. And in retrospect, that's such a strange thing as well. But in a room full of boys, you know, I hadn't cried. And when I was writing the story, it was during the first lockdown, I was writing the story, and I just Googled the teacher's name. I just thought, if I ever get a chance, if I can find out where he lives, I'll go to his house and ask him why he did it. But he died. He died recently. And there were huge tributes to him. He was involved in a football club outside of the school. And there were tributes to him about what a giant of the club he'd been and what a great coach he'd been. And well, it certainly wasn't the man who I encountered. So the school was bizarre. I mean, even I left school in 1976. And I started teaching myself in 1979 in a community school, a mile from the school I went to. But it may as well have been a different planet. You know, the atmosphere was so different. So it wasn't like a generational thing at that stage in Ireland. Now, community schools were still, you know, pioneering the places, but they were becoming the norm. And it was co-ed, boys and girls together, young staff. Corporal punishment, it was made clear to us, wasn't an option. It was made illegal a few years later anyway. But the atmosphere was entirely different. And I meet these people I used to teach. I'm friendly. I'm good friends with some of them in their 50s now. And they look back in the school like they loved it. Most of them, the ones I meet anyway. Granted, we tend to look back on these things, you know, nostalgically. But any version of nostalgia that I'd be using as I look back at my own school, secondary school days would not be rosy.
What's the point at which, though, the kind of character decides to rebel and have the bollocks to not believe they're the piece of shit that the leather strap wants you to think you
are?
To
me, it always seemed to be natural as a teenager. Like, I, you know, my father lived till he was 90 and we became really, really good friends. But there was that phase when I was a teenager and maybe up into my early 20s when I thought he was just a gobshite and everything he said was ludicrous and stupid. And he was born a year after the state was founded in 1923, you know. So he, in many, many ways, represented what the state had become. And I know now, he was a terrific father. He was brilliant. He was really, really great and very intelligent man and a really nice man. But I went through that phase where everything he represented was just ludicrous.
Did you like your work?
The last book he read was, he reread it, was A Star Called Henry. He absolutely loved that book. He thought it was just the way I used history. He thought it was brilliant. He really, really liked it.
What about the Commitments era and all that? Was he in
there? No, I don't think he would particularly have liked the Commitments for the simple reason that he didn't get it, I think. But he was really pleased that it was happening. I think he was a printer. He served his apprenticeship for 7 years. And then he went on. He was a printer then with the Irish Independent. And he was doing a lot of shift work, evening work, night work. Two, my older sisters had been born and he didn't want to do night work anymore. So he went into teaching printing in Bolton Street College of Technology, as it was called at that time. So he was teaching compositing, you know, that aspect of printing and graphic design. And then he went to, he was one of the first people to go into ANCO, what became FOSS, you know, coordinating the training of apprentices. But I do think he would have loved to have had a stab at what I did. Not writing, I think he'd love to have been a visual artist. And I remember when he went to night classes in the College of Art, and that I think he would have loved that. And I think he was delighted then when I struck out and started doing this. But he wouldn't have, you know, why would he have liked the Commitments? I mean, he was Frank Sinatra. I mean, that was as racy as he liked, you know, musically. But he really did like the fact that I was publishing books and that's what I was doing.
Was there any element of the father and the Commitments, Jimmy Robert Sr., that was at all based on your
brother? I feel like, yeah. I think when I'm writing, I don't think too carefully about where these things are coming from. You know, I just write them. And sometimes later on, I kind of acknowledge to myself that's where it came from. So that
have
father,
you ever taken something out because you think that's too personal?
No,
that mate will know.
I wouldn't go in the first place. If it's literally about me, I'm grand with that. it's so rare that I actually use something that may be personal, not just to me, but for somebody else. And I have on occasion spoken to people who I might have witnessed something with, or we would have endured something together. And I'd ask them, would they be okay with that? And it's quite amazing how some of them have said, God, I'd love that. Like, they love to think an episode which wasn't particularly good can be transferred or can be made into art.
That kind of evaporates the pain of it in ways.
No, I wouldn't say it's therapeutic.
Would you find your writing in general has been therapeutic?
No, it's not therapeutic, but I've just finished my 13th novel and I'm, dipping into the 14th one. And I get, at my age, I'm 65, so I'm retiring age. The idea of retirement means nothing to me. And I get huge personal satisfaction from still being able to write, from still being able to come up with ideas, which get harder and harder, because sometimes I'd be writing something and it feels a bit familiar because I realise, oh, Jesus, I wrote this fucking thing before. Mm. So the challenge, it never gets easier, and there's a colossal satisfaction, which I suppose is, that has to be psychological, doesn't it?
Do you have the same passion when you sit down now as you did for the big ones back in the day? Or you kind of go,
yeah,
because
if I didn't,
I'm Randy Doyle, these will sell.
If I didn't, I wouldn't do it. Now, the passion might be different. I was thinking about it this morning because I work on a laptop, And the first books were written by hand. When I'd done what I thought was the finished thing, I used to rent an electric typewriter.
Yeah. So yeah. You scribbled down the commitments.
In copybooks. I didn't realise, at the Charles Dickens house in London, there's a manuscript. I can't remember which novel it is. But when you look at it, it's exactly like cut and paste. He would rewrite a paragraph and paste it on top of the old paragraph. So he was doing exactly what we do now, except it would have been much, much slower. But he still ended up producing way more work than the average novelist would ever do.
But the ease of it now has taken away from motivation.
I don't think so. I mean, it's not like the difference between building your own house or moving into a house that somebody else has built for you. I don't think that.
Are you against the notion of being the guy who criticises the new generation coming up?
I'd be very loath about criticising younger people. Just if I hear the cranky old lad in me, I want to know why I'm being cranky. Sometimes for the crack, that's fine. And I'm not on Twitter or whatever it's called these days.
So I couldn't give a shite.
I do have a Facebook account and I used to post dialogue stuff. And I don't really do that anymore because anytime I turn on Facebook, it's just ads and I'm not interested. So
would you be aware that all our cultural mechanisms of survival are on their fucking knees?
Well, that I don't know about. I mean, I see a good game of football. Like I watched in the Women's World Cup, Colombia versus Germany, and it was as good a game of football as I've seen in years. It was brilliant, really brilliant, really exciting. There'll be a match on tomorrow, some stage, several, and I might watch one of them. I tend to put it on the minute the game starts. If I'm not there, I tend to put it on the minute the game starts, and I'll watch it, and I tend to turn it off when the match is over. And really, the lives of the players outside the stadium don't mean an awful lot to me. I think it's really interesting. I remember I saw a short documentary about Didier Drogba, who left his family home in the Ivory Coast when he was 6 to go to France to live with his uncle because they saw the potential. And I started crying. I think I don't do very often, but it just struck me as so, so sad that he was sent out basically to feed the family, the village, that was his role. And then when you think how brilliantly he carried it off, and then you might think about people we've never heard of who never managed it. The thousands of Brazilian players who are playing in Europe somewhere who we'll never hear of and don't earn the fortunes that the others are making. So I think for every multimillionaire, there are hundreds and probably thousands who are, barely eking out a living, who are being injured irrevocably at the age of 19 and 20, who are suffering homesickness in the same way that George Best's pal did. I can't remember his name, the fellow who went back to Belfast. And didn't George Best go back as well and had to be persuaded to go? Yeah. So I think these lads are much the same as they ever were, really. I think we're exposed to them much more. I mean, there's way too much on. And the constant press conferences, I mean, I knew who the manager of Chelsea was when I was a kid. It was Dave Sexton. And I think I might have heard him speak about twice.
Yeah.
And we knew the Bill Shankly quotes. But that wasn't because we heard Bill Shankly every day. It was because he said something once. And a lot of times it was worth listening to. So it was like a joke that was passed on from person to person to person. But I think now there's way too much focus on the punditry. And it's getting more and elaborate and stupid all the time. And some of them are really good. But I think it's people who are beyond football playing age, 40s, 50s, 60s, who fancy themselves no longer as the players, but as the managers. So they're the ones who are watching Sky Sports. And they're the ones who are really interested in systems, as opposed to getting the football and going out and dumping it. And pretending they understand Jamie Carragher. There was a statistic I saw, and most of the statistics are stupid, I think. But there was one I saw during a game, I think it was earlier in the week, was it Wolves and Manchester United? The amount of time it was taking the teams to get the ball back. Wolves, it was 8 seconds. Manchester United was 18 seconds. And I thought that was a very telling statistic and what was wrong with Manchester United, even though they won the game. And I think sometimes that's interesting. But when you get, sort of, they seem to have gone from a 4-3-3 to a 4-4-2. And to most people, including myself, that's not immediately apparent when you're watching it on the telly. I'll give you the example. When Claude Makélélé played for Chelsea, if Chelsea were on the telly, you rarely heard mention of Claude Makélélé. But if he were there, it was astonishing to see what he was doing. Mm. But because it wasn't spectacular, and because it was like mopping up, and because he rarely scored a goal or was involved in a goal, you'd rarely hear about him. And it was only then when you actually saw him in action that you realised, well, that's what football is about.
But then there was a role named after him, and all. Then he became proper iconic. And then when Kante came along and recreated exactly, essentially, what Makélélé did, he became one of the most talked about players in the country. Yes. So he was just the first mover.
Yeah.
It was like the band who weren't spoken of, and the band who copies them comes along and breaks the world.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple of hundred people bought their album. Yeah. And then, yeah. It's like the GPO in 1916. Yeah. There was, what, three lads in it, but 3,000 claimed to be in it years later.
Would you be Republican?
I suppose when it's allied to democracy and the notions of democracy and the notion that we are the state and that we're not subjects, we're citizens, I consider myself a Republican. But it's a word
would
you have to...
Would you be anti-British at all?
No. Only in the casual pub sense.
Do you hope the England football team lose when they play in it?
Funnily enough, love seeing the England men lose. Don't feel that way towards the English women.
Is that because you always find England as a symbol of kind of white misogyny? So actually,
it's the England expects. It, funny enough, there you go. The England team is very multiracial in that way. You know, it's a strange thing about women's football is that, with the exception of France, European football seems to be very white. I think there's also the aspect of it that in some countries, women's football or girls' football is quite middle class, you know, in a way that it's not elsewhere. It's like women's football in America. It's like it's very much a middle class occupation.
Would it be in England though?
That I don't know, but I do know. I remember the odd time I'd be looking at a domestic game, you know, Chelsea or Manchester United or something, which is rare enough. But or I'd be reading a bit about, say, Karen Carney or one of the, you know, the more famous footballers or ex-footballers, and a lot of them seem to have academic qualifications, you know. That a lot of them are teachers, a lot of them have been to college, they've done, you know, quite elaborate degrees and masters, which you, I suppose, wouldn't be the norm in men's football.
Do you think there's an element of patronisation the way we're going on about female football?
Yeah, that's a danger, I suppose.
Like the goal that Ireland scored in the World Cup is a mistake off a corner, and the goalkeeper who concedes that's the third best goalkeeper in the world, fourth best goalkeeper in the world. It's not a good look for the women's game for us to be claiming that that is a Ray Houghton moment. And also, they should shrink the goals.
I don't know about that. I really don't know.
The average height of the goalkeeper is 4 to 5 inches smaller.
I think, I mean, somebody told me in a pub a few weeks ago that the women's team had a training match against, you know, the fifth team of a League of Ireland second division team, and they were hammered. And to me, it was irrelevant. You know, when it's 11 women playing against 11 women, that's when it matters. And yeah, Katie McCabe's goal, it was brilliant insofar as Ireland scored it. And it looked, and it was spectacular. It was, I think, probably an accident. But
it was poor goalkeeping.
When it's, well, you know, there's plenty of that. There has been in the Women's World Cup. But I suppose as proof that it's not patronising or some sort of low-level proof, if there's a woman's game on one channel and a man's game on in the other channel, perchance I'll watch the man's game because that's what I've grown up with and that's what I love. But I do love it when things open up. You know, when the Leave Insert, this awful examination system that we have in Ireland, when it had to be abandoned when there was lockdowns and they did an alternative way of assessing the intelligence or the success of students. And there was outrage because they normally, the traditional schools that get all the good points weren't getting them. And schools that had no real history of sending vast numbers to college were getting them. I just loved that. I really, really loved it because I thought there was a certain honesty to it. And also it was opening up doors that had been slammed shut for years and years.
Complete classism, really, the Leave Insert system.
Absolutely, yeah. I think when something happens and an opportunity is given to either individuals or, you know, vast amounts of people, really, in the case of women's football, for example.
How would you view Ireland now as a nation in comparison to what it used to be?
It's an extraordinary place. It never fails to surprise me in ways, you know. Such a horrible little parochial place in ways. The whole big story at the moment is Ryan Tuberty, a radio presenter who's on the air for an hour every morning during the week. And I flicked on the news last night on the telly and I thought, oh, he's after dying, because there was a huge, big, almost biography of his career going right back to when he was a kid. And it wasn't that at all. It was just that there'd been a decision made that he wasn't going to be working for RTE again, the equivalent of the BBC. And this was the big, big story. And, you know, you wouldn't get that anywhere else, I think, in Ireland, or, you know, to my knowledge. But then things like the divorce referendum, you know, going back a bit, the same-sex marriage referendum, the abortion referendum, these are things... Divorce, yeah, I would have anticipated that it was a possibility in my lifetime. I'd never, ever have expected same-sex marriage when I was, say, in my 20s or even in my 30s. And I knew gay people. And the notion that they would be allowed to get married in this country, I just thought was mad. And then within my lifetime, there was a shift. So many things shifted and changed. And it isn't as if then it remains static and we have this thing that'll stay just the way it is for the rest, you know. I suppose there's always swings to the left and right. Dublin's a bit of a mess at the moment, but it's an interesting mess. And I don't think it'll stay the way it is. So it's a strangely contradictory place to be. It's friendly. It's genuinely friendly. People talk. But at the same time, it's a cruel place to live in many, many ways. If you don't have a steady, good, and not just a steady income now, but a good one, you're in trouble. And... strange people say that the homelessness situation is terrible, the health, the quality of the health service is terrible, and they're right in both ways. But I think if it came to the crunch and it came to really, really changing the taxation system, for example, another, there's a fixation in the country with private property and owning private property. It may well go back to the famine. It may well go back to the land wars in the 1880s when the peasantry were given their property, given their land, and it may well. But there is an absolute fixation with it and an unwillingness to see beyond it. So that is really, really frustrating. But at the same time, it's a marvellous place to live in many, many ways. And I've always felt comfortable here, comfortable insofar as I have been able to write exactly what I wanted to write. I've been slammed for it at times, but I've never felt any pressure other than the odd letter back in the day to get out of the country or to move somewhere.
Was the most kind of slammed you ever were after the release of Family in the early 90s?
Yeah, 1994. I got death threats and all sorts of stuff then. It was before social media, not that I'd have paid much attention to it, but... But no, you know, you're always going to get, no matter where you are, you're always going to get the individual who's going to write the death threat. I mean, he's always going to be there. Back then, he had to get a stamp and post it. Now, yeah. He can do it sitting on the jacks, you know. So it's always going to happen. But the thing was broadcast and it caused a storm, but it was still broadcast. I hope I'm making sense. And... people hated it, people loved it, but I was still able to go down to the shops and buy the bread and the milk. You know, and that is, it may seem daft, and it was a decision. The day after the first episode was broadcast, going to the shops was a bigger decision than it normally would be, because the phone was hopping all day. And I was on the headlines, I was the second item on the news, I was on current affairs programmes. Not me, literally, I was the subject. Yeah. I was at home.
Did you get immense anxiety for a few days off that?
A mixture of anxiety, excitement.
Who do I think I am to kind of cause this stuff? Should I have just stayed quiet? This is...
No, I never felt that.
You never felt I'm not the centre of the world, why did I make myself it briefly?
No, I never felt that I shouldn't have done it. I was actually hugely proud of it, you know, hugely proud of it, more so than anything else I've ever done. So I never felt I shouldn't have done it. Years later, I was thinking, not by myself, in a conversation with other people, that when I was getting the death threats, and there was one, like, I think something like that, I'm going to come to your house and burn it. I was the father of a toddler and a baby. And I don't feel guilty about it, but I think now, as I am at the age of 65, that sends a chill down my spine, that I didn't think more about that consequence. I didn't actually for a second think that this guy was going to come around. I'm assuming it was a man. It wasn't signed with a can of petrol and set fire to the house. I didn't think that. But then again, you know, when the lights go out at night, the imagination runs a little riot. But I never thought that... I didn't even go to the guards with those letters, you know. I think if I got something really vicious on, say, through Facebook or, you know, Facebook Messenger or even in the post, I'd go straight round to the station and show it to the guards. I don't know if they could do anything about it, but I think I probably would do it now and probably would have done it 10 years ago. But it didn't really occur. I just binned the things. I didn't even keep them. So...
Would care enough though to send that? It was probably someone from the establishment.
There was one I got from a priest after The Snapper came out, the film, and it was handwritten, and he had seen the film on the recommendation of his friends, fellow priests, who said it was wonderful, and he went to it and he thought it was absolutely disgraceful and terrible, and he just saw no place for this sort of thing in the country. And I think the final sentence was, I'm not sure literally, but it was something like that, you know, we don't want you here, Mr. Doyle, in your own words, fuck off, yours, father such and such. I like to think he's in Arbor Hill prison now, you know. But I just laughed that off, and I showed it to a few people, and then I binned it. I think I binned it anyway. Who knows? Maybe, you know, years from now when I'm dead and people are going through, you know, the books and stuff, it'll fall out. But I think I just binned it, you know.
Do you fear death at all?
Not really, no. I mean, I'm quite at home with the notion that I'm mortal. You know, when you witness the death of your parents and you witness the death of friends, and you live through this, and you familiarise yourself with grief and the different ways it hits you. And personally, the notion that I won't exist, and it'll be sooner rather than later, I don't think it's any great loss for mankind, to be honest with you. It's always a personal thing. I suppose it's easy to talk in these ways, but if I was told the next 3 years of your life are going to be roaringly painful, if you wake up dead, you know that, you know, grand. Or if I stupidly walk in front of a bus, grand. Or if I find out of Alzheimer's and I'll book the one way flight to Switzerland or whatever, whoever it'll take me.
Would you?
Oh yeah, would you?
Do you think we should allow that happen in Ireland?
Yes, I do. I think it should be really carefully done, you know. I think, you know, as far, I read an article about it happening in Canada, and then a lot of second thoughts about what they'd done. Maybe it was too liberal. And I don't like the idea of people being allowed just to say, I'll take a lethal injection because I don't really want to live anymore. I think there's a certain responsibility to being alive, you know. And I do feel that. But if I thought my life was going to go downhill and I'm just going to be...
What do you mean by a certain responsibility to being alive?
Well... I suppose, you know, one of my closest friends, one of the lads I would have been laughing at the back of the classroom with, he died 5 years ago. And horrible experience to, you know, obviously for his family, more so than for me, brain tumour. But he didn't want to die. I mean, a few months before it became apparent that he wasn't well, he was so full of life, and we used to go to gigs together, and we were all sorts of plans, and, you know, we just loved being in one another's company. And then, you know, he had the brain tumour, and within about 6 months he was dead. And I mean, I don't have a brain tumour. I'm perfectly healthy, really, you know, for a man of my age, I'm probably very healthy. And I just don't think, I think it sounds a bit pompous maybe to say I have a responsibility to stay alive, but yeah, I don't, you know, probably wasn't right in expressing it that way. But I think, you know, their life is there to be lived, really, you know. And does death worry me? I suppose to a degree it does worry me, but it's how you get there.
You don't feel, you don't...
Non-existence.
The dread of the pointlessness.
I suppose that's what gives life its point, is the coming pointlessness.
Yeah.
That's why, I mean, you grab what you can. I don't mean in a greedy sense, but... Or I don't think
you
I do.
You mean positive experiences?
Yeah. And enjoying small things, like, you know, I'm trying to think of something
about it. To the pointlessness as well, because you can forgive yourself. I know there's much easier, which was the problem with the freaks that were going around slapping you in the corridors of the school, was this
about
lie.
The afterlife and
the lie of the afterlife,
heaven and hell.
It gives you the concept of punishment, really, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If it's pointless, why care too much about anything to a point of stress?
It's a moral issue, isn't it? Yeah. And I mean, this is where I get back to maybe democracy, republicanism, taking responsibility for your own life, your life as an individual and your life as a citizen, that your role is not to, you know, cause pain because there are no consequences. Well, there are in a lot of cases, but your life is to be is there to be lived and to be shared.
Do you believe in the concept of a human being evil, or do you think
I'm not sure. I'm wary of the word evil. I think it's a brilliant word, but
because it's a label that allows us to distance ourselves from the fact that our society calls people.
Well, it also takes, if you call Hitler, I thought I'd get away without saying Hitler, but if we take Stalin,
yeah,
you know, call him evil, it seems to absolve him of responsibility for what he did, because he becomes devilish.
Exactly, and the only way you avoid those future situations are by realising that we did make them what they were, based off the fact that we were over-evolved fish.
Yeah.
They didn't just wake up one day and go, I want to absolutely destroy other people. There's an immense pain in there from injustice originally.
Yeah. Well, yes, Hitler was elected, you know, which we tend to forget.
You mean elected in terms of that means
he was democratically elected.
There was enough people who empathised with him at the time. That means they shared.
At that time.
Exactly. And they shared his pain.
Yeah.
Hitler's a fascinating character.
I've never really found Hitler fascinating.
Not fascinating in terms of him as an individual, but the take on Hitler, as you're saying, that label of just evil, forget him, delete him, delete the name Adolf and castrate all his relatives.
And he's easy to lampoon, and it's easy. I mean, what's the film Downfall? That passage from Downfall, you know,
the
where
rant,
it's used.
That's, yeah.
The original one, I think, was when Sheffield United were relegated. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant, because Hitler's so easy to lampoon. The moustache, the hair. It's as if he, you know, he was way ahead in terms of his image, do you know?
He's been turned in a way as well, Christ-like, like in terms of he has become that of myth. He has become non-human in the evil distancing, even though Hitler is a representation of how rotten.
Well, I think people, either for good or for bad, they stop being human somehow. Princess Diana, you know, she was just a young one, you know, a young woman who ends up marrying the future king.
To an extent, though, but she came from a kind of valuation system in her
family.
Yeah, but
then she was
that.
Just a young one of average intelligence like everybody else, and no great reason why she'd stand out in the crowd at all. And yet then she became a saint. Why? You know, and other people become saints, or they become devils. And it is interesting. In every case, they stop being human. You know, if that's what happens, they stop being human somehow in the eyes of people.
That's what politics is as well. It's a kind of quest for dehumanisation. Like the concept of even the Taoiseach, does that have 20 years left in it? A head of state in any capacity?
Yeah. It remains to be seen if the Elon Musks of the world manage to make the state an irrelevance. But
yeah.
I'd give you an idea, you know. I mean, again, it's parochial, but it's an Irish thing as well. I think because the country is relatively small, a lot of us know where a politician lives, or we went to school with one of his kids. So the politicians are, if you like, known as human beings. The minister for, who was the minister for finance, I can't remember, O'Donoghue. He's a Bohemians fan. You see him in Dalymount some Friday evenings. And he's not there because he's a politician. He's there because he likes watching football. And someone I know was at a international conference in All Hallows College, or what was All Hallows College in Glasnevin. And it was a summer just before the lockdown, glorious weather, absolutely glorious weather. And after the day's lectures or whatever, there were groups of people outside sitting around on the grass. And Bertie Ahern, the ex-Taoiseach and Prime Minister of this country, lives very nearby. And his father was the groundsman or gardener for All Hallows. And his father, and Bertie walks through it apparently every evening. And somebody saw him, one of the Irish delegates saw him, and went over to him and said, would you come over and meet, and told him who they were, that it was a conference, and would he come over and meet some of the delegates from other parts of the world. And he did. He went over, said hello, sat down on the grass with them, chatting away from where they came from. And the person who was there, who I know, was said the reaction, particularly from the African delegates, was just they could not believe that they were basically having a chat with a man who had been the prime minister of the country, that they could be so close to him that you could just, they couldn't imagine it, you know. So, but it was, to me, I found when I was told that, I thought, oh, well, you know, it's not the most profound thing I've ever heard, but it just, again, it just, it felt like a good thing. It's hard to imagine that happening with Boris Johnson, for example, that he'd be wandering around by himself and that it wouldn't become some sort of a big photo opportunity, or he'd, you know, it'd become a public thing. But there's no photographic evidence of this thing happening at all, because that wasn't what it was about. It was just a half an hour of chatting.
We carry the oppression and depression of our constant slavery genetically, and that's why Irish,
I think, writing. Yeah, I do think to a degree. I don't know how you inherit these things. I don't know if it's genetic or whatever, but I do think that something like the famine has to have a profound impact, not just on well, the population declined so quickly, but it has to have a profound impact on both on society, but also on the individual psyche.
But and I think it is like Vikings, Normans, the whole.
Well, you go back to Cromwell. I mean, I read recently, I read this brilliant book about Cromwell and the 10 years of the Republic in Britain, in England, and what I didn't realise that was, you know, Cromwell comes to Ireland, Cromwell leaves Ireland, the population has declined by 1/5, you know, either through slaughter or starvation. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, you say, oh, that's ages ago, but still it has to have an impact. In the same way that, I mean, the descendants of slaves have to, it's in there.
Yeah.
It's part of their makeup, yeah, and has to be respected, I think.
Yeah. The island aspect of what Ireland is as well just made, yeah, us such a landing point, and then emigration was always such a big deal as opposed to, yeah, floating into Europe and remixing.
Yeah, it's a very
unique country.
Yeah, it also makes it a small world. I remember my father saying, I mean, he had no great sense of direction, but he said, you can never get lost. You'll always,
yeah,
you'll eventually reach the sea. Now, maybe on the wrong side. So maybe Galway Bay.
Do you think our creative overachievement isn't just due to the fact that we speak the commercial language? It's due to that pain.
Well, it's the one thing that I would be grateful to the British Empire for, you know, imposing the English language on us. It's been very good to me.
Yeah.
But so I don't think it's that we, that notion that, you know, back to boxing, do we punch above our weight? I think we're too inclined to say that. I'm not sure if it is the case. Although, you know, I'm quite happy to celebrate the fact that we do have a lot of really good writers, you know. But you could say, yeah, possibly English is a huge advantage because, you know, compare, are there fewer writers in Germany? Possibly not, but are they known as well throughout the globe? No,
so
because
it doesn't
link to translate
generations of empathy.
Sorry?
Generations of empathy has nothing got to do with it.
Empathy with what?
Knowing what pain is and therefore being able to express
it to
the masses.
We are different. We are different. I mean, it's there's no doubt at all the way we speak English and certainly the way I write English. The Irish language, about which I couldn't have a decent conversation in at all, but it's still bubbling under the way we speak English. And you could probably do an analysis and people would say, well, the Doyles came from the East Coast, so they weren't actually speakers of Irish in the first place. But that would be missing the point, I think. I think it's not a sham thing. I think, you know, I'm an atheist and have been aware of the fact that I'm an atheist for the last nearly, I would have been 16, 17 when I decided it was a lot of
rubbish.
Was it
battered out of you or was it just...
No, it just didn't make sense to me. It wasn't a violent thing at all. I wasn't reacting to it.
Would you get high the odd time on your teenage years?
Very, 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 very occasionally, but my experience of drugs is very, very limited. Very, very limited. Beyond coffee and alcohol. I took mushrooms once and it was a spectacular experience that I'm going to repeat. Yeah.
What age were you?
23, 22, one of those.
And did it give you insight and clarity?
I've used it creatively so many times.
Just the one experience, yeah?
Yeah.
Why didn't you go back? Because you just thought you got enough from
it? Well, I think I was lucky to be alive the following day.
Okay.
It was, it was a day out that went spectacularly wrong.
Yeah. Did it genuinely change your writing style? Yeah, a bit of kind of John Lennon.
Not my writing style.
But
no,
your guts and your ability to know what was important.
I was looking. I was sitting on the banks of the Grand Canal. Was the Grand Canal? Yeah, and the grass on the other side was miles away. And I blinked, and I could see every blade. And I blinked again. It was miles away. And I blinked again. I could see every blade. And I was walking down the street. What was probably hours later, but felt like minutes later. And I turned around and I was following myself. And it made perfect sense. And I've used things like that when people feel disconnected. And, you know, we would all have moments in our lives, you know, and I can, maybe somebody at the age of 20 would be wondering what I'm talking about. But, you know, my stage in life, we all have moments in our lives where we do feel disconnected, where things don't make sense, either physical sense or psychological sense. When I'm trying to describe that creatively, I can fall back on that experience and vary it. I can fall back on personal experience that occurred to me. I was talking recently, actually earlier today, to a man, spent a night in A&E in a city centre hospital 30 years ago on a Friday night. And, you know, Dante's hell, Jesus. And I've kind of used that again and again and again and again. The images I saw, the impressions I was left with. These things, you don't, at no case, and I was like, at that stage, I was probably working on my fifth novel. I just happened to, you know, something happened and I had to go to the A&E. And at no stage did I think, I'll be using this. It wasn't that, I was living it. And witnessing it. And the same with the mushrooms, you know, the following day, I don't know if I'd started writing. I hadn't at that stage. I was still messing around. But at no point ever in my life have I thought, wow, I'll write about this at some stage. But it often comes up to you and kind of knocks on your head and says, you know what, maybe the time has come to write something about this. I've never really written about my teaching experience, even though I was 14 years a teacher. I've only little glimpses of it ever. And I wondered about that recently, why I suppose I was afraid of invading other people's lives. But I don't feel that way anymore. When you're a teacher, it is in a way, yeah, you're kind of, you're under the glass, so to speak, because I think I always saw it as a branch of show business in a way, because every eccentricity, every tick, every clothing decision you make becomes big, and you have to be, you know, you kind of ignore it. But if you think back to your own school, I mean, teacher comes in and there's a bit of hair sticking out, and it's the funniest thing ever.
Is the Commitments still the best known work of your, in terms of when you die, will RTE say Commitments writer?
Oh, I think in Ireland, no, The Snapper will be the thing they'll show that night, I'd say.
Will it?
Oh, yeah. The Snapper is the one that so many people who weren't born when I wrote it know off by heart.
Did you see Carragher talk about The Commitments?
No.
Yeah, he was asked his favourite film on something recently. He goes, probably The Commitments.
There are footballers of a certain generation who I've met who really love The Commitments for some
Norden.
Reason.
Manchester, Liverpool kind of area.
Yeah, where Soul is big. In terms of writing, the blank page, even though it's a screen and not a page anymore, is still a bit frightening, you know? Starting something. There's a certain level of excitement, but it always is a bit frightening. It's a lot, takes a lot of filling, you know? And it takes more filling as I get older. But the notion that you don't look back, like 65 years I'm dragging behind me and an awful lot of images and experiences, parenthood, teaching, grief, joy, you know, youth, age, illness, you know, all sorts of images there to be used. The Commitments is very much a book written by a young man. The manager, Jimmy Rabbit, looking forward, looking forward, looking forward. Ironically, music from the past, which seemed like way, way back, but it's only 10 years, 20 years back. But looking forward, looking forward, looking forward. Now, I sitting down to write now, it's not Jimmy Rabbit. You know, it's an older, you know, the book I'm thinking of writing at the moment is going to be a man roughly my own age. The book I'm just finished is a woman my own age. You don't look forward as much, you know. Because there isn't much there. So it's like the angle of the camera changes as you get older, or I found. And I find it, while I'd much rather not be getting older, I find as a source of inspiration, it's fascinating. The one I just finished, and I'm kind of giving it one last edit at the moment, the final chapter, the last chapter is roughly about half the book, and it wasn't the last chapter that I wrote. I wrote it actually not at the very beginning, but about halfway through. It just made more sense. But I remember when I was writing it, I absolutely loved writing it. I just felt so good writing it. Just so brilliant. And I knew, in me gut, I knew, well, I've never done anything quite like this before. I've never structured a book in this way before. I've gone back to characters I've written about before, but I've never actually, as I said, structured a book or approached it in this way before. So it's a character called Paula Spencer from Family and The Woman Who Walked Into Doors and the book Paula Spencer and her daughter, one of her daughters, Nicola. And it's like this excruciating conversation between the two of them. And it's something that I'd rather not witness in real life, but when I was writing it, I just felt so, at one level, exhilarated. And at the same time, I really felt, yeah, this is what I do. This is what I do, you know. And it felt, I suppose, because it was the 13th novel I was writing, I felt more confident in a way as well, you know. So it's that balance between feeling confident because you've done it before and feeling anxious because so what? You know, just because you did it before doesn't mean it's going to be any good. But during the time when I was writing that particular chapter, I just felt I'm able to write this because I've written 12 books beforehand, and I wouldn't be able to write this if I hadn't done that. And this is something new that I'm building on top of all the old stuff that I wrote, and it just felt fucking great.
When you're writing about something like domestic abuse and that kind of level of pleasure you're getting from telling the story, is it, I'm helping people, they'll be able to relate to this? Is the pleasure from your own creativity and maximization of your life experience?
It is. I like to think that I'm writing something that achieves an honesty that seems human, that seems like it's validly the thoughts of the character or the actions of the character. I don't think ahead or anticipate, certainly when I'm working, sometimes when the work is finished, you kind of daydream. But I'm not thinking about comfort that people might get from reading it. Or I had encountered when Family came out and when The Woman Who Walked Into Doors came out, I got endless amounts of letters and kind of personal approaches from women saying that they thought they were the only woman who'd been in a bad, violent marriage. And it was so good, in a way, to witness what they were watching on the screen or reading about. And I thought that was great, but it wasn't why I wrote the book.
How does a character enter the mind? Is it kind of a...
It's a slow, it's all about words. It really is all about words.
Before the writing, do you think it's a series of events that makes mini imprints that
I don't really know. I don't really know. You're kind of, you know, I'm imagining her or any other character, where is she sitting? Does she pay attention to what she's looking around at? Are the curtains important? Is the couch important? Does it have a history? How does she feel when she's standing up?
And that's about the words you choose to describe this.
As in, is she getting lightheaded?
Is she sober? At one stage, it would have been, is she sober? Is she drunk? Is the couch a broken thing that's, you know, that, you know, we've all sat in couches where you sink down way further than is, you know, comfortable, and the impossibility of climbing out. And I think virtually everything I'd start off with, it's positioning somebody in a room. And then you begin to wonder about the room. I don't necessarily describe everything in the room, because no more than I've read, you know, quite a few novels recently where a character walks in and their clothes are described, because they've been told that, I think it's quite apparent that the writer at some early stage in their career was told, this is what you do.
Mm.
You describe the character physically and you describe what they were wearing.
Yeah, what is your education in...
I had no education whatsoever. Just a love of reading. Yeah, no formal education, no.
Do you think that kind of thing can be taught? Do you agree?
I don't think writing can be taught, but I think good advice can be absorbed. So I wouldn't write off, you know, writing classes or anything like that.
What about like a 4-year degree in creative writing?
I think it's a bit ludicrous that I wouldn't be allowed to teach in quite a lot of American colleges because I don't have a PhD in writing.
Yeah.
Whereas a guy who's never had a book published would be allowed to teach because he has a PhD. I don't want to, you know, so it's not on my list of things I want to do. But I think maybe the formality of it is a bit absurd. But I wouldn't write it off. I'd never write it off. I think I can think of plenty of people I know who have degrees in writing or have done postgraduate degrees. And I think one of the big things about it is that they've been allowed to spend time writing and maybe getting advice from people with experience. And I think that's probably quite a useful thing. But it wasn't available when I was, or if it was, I didn't know about it when I started writing. And possibly if we go back to all the other writers before me, it's probably much the same case in most cases.
Do you just trust your audience and trust your reader to understand you?
I have to trust myself, first of all. You know, I have to make sure that it is as I want it and that it's worth reading. And I do believe then that the reader fills in gaps. I have lots of respect for any reader who's reading. I don't necessarily think the reader needs to know, for example, the colour of the hair of a character who's going to talk. I don't think it matters in most cases. Sometimes it's interesting and it'll go in. But I think it's all about me, really. So when I was working earlier today, I was just looking at what I'd done and making slight changes and looking at it again. And looking at it again and deciding, is this exactly as I want it?
So many different people have so many different interpretations of what you've written. Some people would find Paddy Clark funny. Some people would find it tragic.
That's a generational thing as well. I do reread quite a lot of books that I read when I was much younger. And I find some of them are still brilliant, but they're much darker than they were when I read them, as when I was a young man, you know. Like things like The Death of a Child. In a book, The Accidental Tourist by Anne Tyler. I was rereading it recently. I read it when I was in my mid-20s. And the first chapter, this couple who are separating because of the death of a child. And I didn't remember that bit. And it's the only thing I'll really remember. You know, it's the only thing I'd remember now. It's funny. And I'd Swim Two Birds, I read every couple of years. You know, the Flann O'Brien novel. And it's a glorious piece of work. But it gets darker and darker and darker the older I get, you know. And other books I find unreadable. Catch 22. I still think it's possibly a brilliant book, but I suspect you have to be quite young to really appreciate it. Because I got through 30 pages and I just couldn't read anymore.
And things get brighter as well, though.
Dark comedy gets better and better. Because I suppose we've had glimpses of the dark side. And anybody who can make, you know, anything that can, anybody who can make people laugh about death, pain, physical decay, collapse of marriage and... You know, psyche. Anybody can make that funny.
But in life, do you kind of find the idea of like giving a shit what people thought ever to be immensely humorous now?
I find, I think it's true. It's not necessarily literally true, but I think as I've got older, I've cared less about what people think. I couldn't give a shite what most people think about me particularly. People I know, people I actually know.
Even if like a book was picked up by
I mean, I could see if I got a great review in the New York Times, I'd be chuffed. But I'd forget about it really quickly. But I'd be delighted because it probably would have an impact on sales. And if it was somebody I respected, say if it was somebody who I used to read, whose reviews I've read and bought books on their recommendation, and then they write a good review, I'd be delighted. Yeah, chuffed. bad review from somebody I don't know really leaves me on. When I know a review is going to be bad, when I'm, you know, going through it and you realise after the second paragraph, oh, this is shite, I don't read it. I don't read it. I had a huge satisfaction of meeting somebody who'd written a bad review of one of my books. And he said, I reviewed one of your books. And I said, oh, that's not right. And he said, yeah, did you read it? And I said, no. And his face, he was desolate. And it was great because I had read it. But somebody who I know very well was in an audience with me. He was in the audience and I was doing the thing. And this man kind of stood, you know, the questions at the end of this reading I was given. And he said, he gave reasons why he didn't like my work. And he was quite polite about it, you know. And I just said, I hope quite politely, I don't care. You know, it was the honest answer. And I didn't say it in any kind of hostile way. It was the honest answer. I don't care. And I didn't care. My publisher and editor, a man called Nicholas Skidmore, and previously the man who published all my work until he retired, Dan Franklin. These are the people who I want, actively want to read my work and tell me what's wrong with it and what could be better about it. There are others for emotional reasons. You just want them to read it. You know, a few family members, perhaps, you just want them to read it. So a couple of friends. So it becomes just less private somehow or other. It's not something you can measure. It's just, I don't know, how you compose a song and you record a song and you just, you know, you want people to hear it. And you don't want comments. You just want them to hear it. And it's something like a bit of a burden off your shoulders or something like that. So there is that, you know, every couple of years when I finish a book.
Do you think if Joyce was around in your era, he would just be a Roddy Doyle, or was there an extra bit of creative freakish old damn?
Joyce wrote these great short stories, which now seem quite conventional, you know, and in terms of the language he used in later books are quite conventional, but they're brilliant. Then Portrait of the Artist, opening chapters, little boy, older boy, kind of obnoxiously intelligent, late teens, whatever. And the language goes with as the boy ages. And that's brilliant as well. And Ulysses is just an extraordinary piece of work, really. Excuse me. And I think, yeah, Joyce, I think Bloomsday, you know, any Dubliner, a lot of Dubliners, look at people wandering around wearing the, you know, dressed as wearing the bowler hats or the straw hats or whatever, and just think, what a gang of wankers, you know. And I think that myself a bit. And I like to think if there was a Commitments Day and I was wandering around Dublin and I saw people dressed as the Commitments, I think it's harmless, but I think they're a bunch of idiots, really, you know. I was at an event, it's 20 years ago, it must be close enough to 20 years ago. Colin McCann was there as well and Frank McCourt, and we were talking about Ulysses. And I said, half in jest, but half seriously, it could do with a good edit. And there was laughter in the audience. There were a couple of hundred people there. It was in New York. There was laughter in the audience. And what I didn't know was that it caused a storm, caused a eruption. It came later, you know. And for years, all I was asked about was about Joyce. Why do you hate Joyce? I said, I don't hate Joyce. But it was the notion that he's beyond criticism. You know, we forget, like, he was a human being. And, you know, the work of a human being is inevitably flawed. It's open to criticism. There's nothing that a human being has ever produced that can't in some way, because it's a matter of opinion and sometimes very valid opinion. So it's when the, like, it's happened to Beckett, it's happened to Joyce, it's happening to Seamus Heaney, possibly. It's almost inevitable, you know, they attain a certain sainthood. And when that happens, and when you get people getting angry,
how would you feel if it was
happening
to you if you saw some 30-year-old?
Oh, I think they'd be dead right. No,
no,
no. I'd like to think. No,
what they think thing though.
I think I'd like to think.
Is there a high form of arrogance to book writing? Because you have to. Trust,
well, you're on your own. It's the purest form of self-employment in many ways. You're literally the same at visual art, I'd imagine. And you got, it's a struggle creating the stuff, you know, and it's a struggle getting it out there.
You need to be more or less
somehow self-confident. You have to.
Does it verge on narcissistic, though?
Well, kind of inevitably, because you're up your own arse for most of the working day, aren't you?
Yeah. Now, you don't really be openly up your own arse as a bloke.
No, I'd like to think not. Not, no, I wouldn't want to be up my own arse. I'm sure. Like, I'm sure it's not a good place to be. But anybody who sits down to write a novel, for example, and starts and gets to the end of it, regardless of how good it is, there's a certain tenacity and resilience there that has to be admired. And I'd be very loath to dismiss anybody who creates a piece of work, because I do think that they are putting their heads on the chopping block, really. But I possibly wouldn't use the word arrogance. I probably would say self-confidence. But right beside it, there's, you know, I know a lot of writers very, very well. And, you know, feeling vulnerable isn't uncommon. If you can, in your art, if you can take all the human emotions, the whole soup of human emotion, and capture it somehow in a piece of work, that takes strength of character, I think, you know. And particularly then when it goes out into the world, if you're lucky.
Was Joyce more open than you in terms of the actual writing about, like, getting a wank on the actual fucking sea?
I don't know about it. I've never in a direct way written about myself, because I don't find myself as a subject interesting.
Is that true though?
I don't really have much interest in broadcasting myself as such. He said, talking to you. It's down to, I would say it again, it's down to the words that you select. And again, seeing me versus Joyce, or me versus, say, a contemporary of mine, who's the more authentic, who writes the better stuff, who suffered more for their art. Generally, we don't really know for a start. I suppose you could say, anyway, you know, going through life, sometimes it can be an endurance, and if it ends up being material that you write about, do you suffer for your art, or do you suffer because you're human? I suspect it's the latter.
Roddy Doyle, thanks very much for coming on my Glenn
Enjoyed
show.
That.
It's been now many years, my boy. You still don't know my shares of joy. No need to go, just take it slow.
Podcast.
And have you heard the Michael Anthony Show? A nice show.
Makes me feel just fine.
What's your help?
Makes me see the light.
What about those tears?
Leave my eyes.
How's it make you feel?
Makes me